Have you noticed that politicians struggle to enact the things they run on? That regardless of who wins elections, lawmakers cannot pass whatever legislation they like? This is the Overton window at work. The idea, coined by the Mackinac Center's Joe Overton, describes the range of ideas that are politically acceptable at any time. And on the Overton Window podcast, we look at how ideas move from being unthinkable to plausible to policy and talk to the people who change what is possible in politics. Now, we host a lecture series for our interns in the summer, and I joke with them that it's designed to help them answer the hardest question that they are going to get from family and friends about their internship. That is, what exactly do you do there at the think tank? Now, thankfully, Donald Bryson has an explanation. Donald is the president and CEO of the John Locke Foundation, a free market think tank in North Carolina. Donald, welcome.
Well, thanks for having me on. Always a pleasure to talk with other people within this space, but also just to be ingratiated with the Mackinac Center, which has such a great reputation nationally and even internationally.
Oh, thank you so much for that. What would you say you do around here?
Well, that's a great question, and I get it from my family an awful lot around the Thanksgiving or Christmas table. My grandmother's favorite question is, how do you even know how to do that? And that's a great question because, and my answer is nobody does because nobody's done it quite like this before. But public policy think tanks are designed essentially with the central audience in mind of being that of lawmakers and policymakers, and giving independent research and analysis on issues that affect North Carolina, Michigan, the United States, wherever they happen to be focused. And think tanks have been around in some form or another as far back as the 1830s, when the Royal United Services Institute was created in Great Britain to study military science. And then later on in the 20th century, we saw things like the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace being created in the United States. The RAND Corporation was created in 1946. I think the American Enterprise Institute, which is the oldest, I guess, right-leaning think tank in the United States, came around in the 1930s, I think in 1932. So the idea has been around for a while of we need experts, maybe with a particular worldview, to help us walk through the societal or governmental problems. And that's what we do here for lawmakers in North Carolina at the John Locke Foundation. It's what the Mackinac Center does in Michigan.
So no lawmaker has to listen to anything you have to say.
No.
But you're here to try to influence public policy, trying to get good policy enacted as you see it. So why do they even bother to care what you say?
Well, that's a great question, right? And it is... more difficult as we have a more interconnected society through the Internet of Things. Think tanks started as academic institutions, generally within a college or a university in a lot of places, and we still have some of those placed within universities. There's the Hoover Institution at Stanford. There's the Mercatus Center at George Mason as really great examples of that. And the idea is that we have academics with particular expertise in economics or labor policy or education policy or political science or whatever, that have solutions that the staff of state lawmakers or members of Congress just didn't have or had not been able to think outside of that box or concentrate on that issue or whatever. So that's where think tanks come from. We are quasi-academic institutions, and we have people with advanced degrees who take on very serious topics and know how to do rigorous quantitative and qualitative research and regurgitate it and synthesize it in such a way that it's usable for lawmakers. But as we've gotten further into the 21st century, we're at a place. Martin Gurry has a book called The Revolt of the Public, and he's a former CIA analyst who's actually working with the Mercatus Center now. And he says that we've now come to a time called the fifth wave, where the Internet of Things, the interconnectedness of society, where we all are connected to all of the information of humanity here, right, at all times, makes it more difficult for institutions that have otherwise claimed authority within society to continue to retain that authority. And that becomes more difficult because
essentially a guy in his basement can call himself a think tank at this point, right? And he puts out some analysis, whether it's right or wrong, he can call himself a think tank. How we retain that authority is through, I think, fidelity to our principles, what we say our mission and vision is for Michigan or North Carolina, and then also just being rigorous with how with the research that we produce. But yeah, why does anybody care what we say is becoming an increasingly difficult question.
Okay, so let me put in there, I think you make a good case for credibility of like, we care about these issues, we're going to stay principled for them, you can trust what we say is true, and that you can rely on us to provide you with good information about these policies. That's only something of what politicians want. They also want something that is popular. That if they enact this, if they do what they say, that there will be rewards for them among their electorate. They get to keep their job. They get and they get supported by their own constituents.
Mm-hmm.
Can't you do something about that?
Well, yes and no. I think we can do some of that. The Overton window is a great example of we can only do in public policy what is possible within the window. Otto von Bismarck said that politics is the art of the possible. And, the Mackinac Center and the John Locke Foundation and most think tanks are 501c3 nonprofits, right? We are nonpartisan by law. We cannot endorse or support candidates or candidate committees or political parties. We can't do anything just to benefit Republicans or just to benefit Democrats. And people have a hard time getting their minds around what that means, because in a lot of people's minds, when we deal in public policy, then we are obviously dealing in politics and we are wielding political power. And that's not really the case. But we can only do what is possible, right? We cannot, except in very few instances, pass a policy that is overwhelmingly unpopular, because you're just not going to get elected officials to do that. There's a variety of ways to do that. Sometimes it takes a long time to get lawmakers to come around to an idea. And I'll point to school choice as the example on this, where, it was the 1950s when Milton Friedman was first writing about private school vouchers, right? And then over time, 1992, we start seeing that with the Wisconsin scholarship or the Milwaukee scholarship program. D.C. comes along around 2000, 2002 with the D.C. Opportunity Scholarship Program. Then COVID happens, right? Well, everybody's really upset about how their child is being educated. They want other options. Oh, there's this ready-made idea called vouchers and education savings accounts, ESAs. And school choice has exploded since that point. So it took time to talk people into that. But at the John Locke Foundation, we also poll a lot of public policy issues, and we make those polls publicly available to a lot of people, and we make it available to the public. And so they can see sort of where the mindset of the public is, how they feel about tax cuts or how they feel about issues like right to work. That is also a helpful tool that we use as think tanks. And then there's just the idea that good policy makes good politics. If you have good outcomes, then this helps over time. But then there's the problem of the sugar rush, right? Of politicians want to feel good in the moment, even though they know that the decision that will make them feel good right now may lead to bad policies further down the line. And, I think think tanks probably spend not the majority of their time, but a significant portion of their time preventing bad things from happening more than we're able to get good things to happen.
Oh, sure. I mean, it depends on the environment that you're in. But I want to kind of get down to brass tacks.
Yeah.
Can you give me an example of, where your work mattered to the North Carolina policy debate?
Sure. I think energy is probably the most recent example on that, where, in a lot of ways, the movement on the right has lost for... Maybe that's changing now, but for a long time, we lost the narrative on carbon and emissions. It was difficult to see how that genie was going to go back in the bottle, or if it was ever going to go back in the bottle. And so in 2020, and then in 2021, Governor Roy Cooper, who's now running for U.S. Senate here in North Carolina, wanted to create a carbon plan to get North Carolina to zero emissions by 2050. And we needed to reduce by 70% by 2030. And the overwhelming, you know, what was possible within the Overton window, what the art of the possible was with that was very difficult to see in a way that was going to be market friendly. We knew what was wanted, and we wanted to stick to our goals, but that was difficult to see. Go ahead.
As in, the governor is like, look, I think it's going to be really politically popular to go carbon free for the state. I don't really have a good idea of how to do that, but I'm going to have going to require us to make some type of plan to get us there, so that we can weigh options that might take some steps towards that popular goal.
Right, and of course, the governor wanted a lot of mandates to put wind and solar energy onto the grid in North Carolina. We don't, at the Locke Foundation, we don't actually care where the electrons come from, but we do want it to be affordable and reliable, right? And mandates don't generally create affordability and reliability. And so while we didn't love the bill that ended coming up out of the General Assembly, what we were able to influence was that cost had to be the number one thing that the Utilities Commission in the state had to take under consideration when they reviewed the new resource plans from the utilities in the state. And when they have to look at affordability and reliability before they look at clean energy, that really limits what they were able to look at. And so now we're seeing more natural gas and nuclear energy than we've ever seen in North Carolina before, because the research pointed us to, if we go all in on solar, go all in on offshore wind, of course, we've got a very windy coast here in North Carolina, we're going to have to overbuild our resource lines and all that. It's going to cost much more. Or we have these ready-made sites for nuclear facilities. We can convert a lot of our coal to natural gas. These are much more reliable and dispatchable forms. And so this has really led to two or three different bills that have come out of the General Assembly in the last 4 years and have been influenced by the research that we've done at the John Locke Foundation. Did we bend on our principles? No, but we found a way to work within what the current sort of zeitgeist was. And so, yeah, we might be reducing carbon emissions, but the point is we need more gigawatts on the grid that can be reliably dispatched. And that's what we're getting.
All right. So kind of walk me through your work on this issue. You said that you need to try and focus or try and get the utility regulators to prioritize affordability and reliability first and foremost before carbon emissions. It seems like that's a simple cost benefit analysis of like, okay, this is cheap gas if we're or cheap electricity. If we're going to increase the cost via these other things, that's the extra cost. What do we get in return for that? We can persuade some people that way. I'm just theorizing what you might have done. What did you actually do to try to get what you wanted on this issue?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people in the think tank space will roll their eyes for the simple fact that we produced two really long reports on energy. and, you know, nothing makes people sort of go into a coma like having to read a white paper. But in a lot of ways, you know, that very difficult, very dense policy research still is the heart and soul of what think tanks do, because we put a lot of rigor, academic rigor, into the work that we do that nobody else is really focusing on. People like solar energy. People like wind energy because they like warm summer breezes and sunshine and rainbows. And who doesn't like those things? But when you put math on paper, it doesn't work out the way you think that it does. Yes, it appears that the sun provides free energy, except that you have to overbuild for the solar panels. And here in North Carolina and in Michigan has the same sort of problem. The sun doesn't always shine. We are not Nevada or Arizona. Right? We get hurricanes here. That's going to be a problem for offshore wind. Yes, it's going to be windy if the turbines can remain standing. There are some geographic realities to that. And so when you combine all of that, and we did two studies, one in 2021 and another in 2024, about literally doing the cost-benefit analysis of we can do this path, or we can do this path. Here are the differences in what the costs are going to be to ratepayers. And when you put that in front of people, it becomes very, very difficult to argue back against it. if the overall goal is to reduce carbon emissions, but this path is more reliable and cheaper, and this path makes you feel better in the short term, but is going to make people pay more over time, then the choices for any responsible lawmaker, regardless of party, is pretty straightforward.
Hey, you did a thing that I think a lot of good think tanks are able to do, which is take a complicated issue, find all the support, because that's part of the important things for having a long report, is to go through all the details, go through all the objections, show your work to the few people who are going to care, because long reports are things that not everyone's going to read. In fact, very few people are going to.
Mm-hmm.
But you do them so that you can establish an important fact or pattern that you can explain to people who don't read the report.
That's right. That's right. That's why we write the really long, you know, 80, 100 pages page reports, but then you always have to have the one pager to go with it.
Okay. So you've written a report, you've condensed it to people. I mean, one of the things that I know a lot, like we spend a lot of time on, I'm not sure about you, is like, now that we've got our message, now that we've got our findings, how can we get this into people's hands, both our lawmakers and the broader population, so that they understand our view and we put ourselves in the best shot to persuade as many people as possible.
That's right. And there's a multifaceted approach to how that's done. Obviously, does a think tank even exist, or does a paper even exist if it's not somewhere on social media? If you've not tweeted about it or put it on Facebook, is it real? And so, you know, obviously there's a very aggressive social media approach. We've done some explainer videos to go in behind what we've done. And then, you know, you just have to have some feet on the ground at the legislative building. We have a state in North Carolina. It's a long story dating back to the 1840s, but we have a state capitol building, but the legislature outgrew it. And so there is a state legislative building where the Senate and the House actually meet. So do you have people down there handing out the reports, doing the meetings, talking, you know, people through the significant talking points of the paper? Do you have people testifying in front of the House Energy Committee, in front of the Senate Utilities Committee, and that sort of thing? Do you have op-eds going out in papers in different communities to continue to put mental pressure on lawmakers, because people are going to talk to them, hey, did you see this thing that I saw in the Shelby Star or in the Winston-Salem Journal? And so it is, in a lot of ways, a think tank. I'm not trying to simplify it, but in a lot of ways, a think tank is a communications firm. We have a particular worldview about public policy. We do our own research, and then it doesn't really matter if we do all that research if nobody knows about it or reads it. So how do we communicate it?
Mm-hmm. Convince me that you are not just here to help one side of the political debate.
That's a great question, and it becomes difficult when we have such a tribalized political culture that we have right now in the United States. Of course, we're seeing a lot of sort of big government protectionism coming out of the Republican Party in North Carolina and nationally now. And you know, for the past 60 years or so, the political vehicle for little c conservatism or free markets or whatever has been the Republican Party. That doesn't mean that the John Locke Foundation or the Mackinac Center has endorsed the Republican Party. It just means that people who run for office have generally been on that side of the aisle. But I talked to my staff. Would that it were more bipartisan. And I talk to my staff all the time. We have Josh Stein is a fairly left-wing Democratic governor here in North Carolina. And I tell my staff all the time, if he comes out tomorrow with a plan to reduce the tax burden, you know, the income tax here in North Carolina, if we don't give it full-throated support or talk about why this isn't a good idea, then we're in the wrong business. The job of the Republican Party is to get Republicans elected. The job of the Democratic Party is to get Democrats elected. Our job is, no matter who is in power, to get the best possible public policy in place for North Carolina. And that is more difficult sometimes than it is in others. Obviously, the Democratic Party, in terms of their worldview, is more left-wing and big government-oriented. There are plenty of big government Republicans as well, and so we have to figure out sort of the weight and flavor of the moment to work in. But our job is, and we use this imagery a lot, is like a lighthouse. We show everybody where the coastline is, and where the rocks are and what direction to take. But it's not always the most popular position to be the person in the room telling everybody to eat their vegetables.
All right. So I think there's one other thing that you can do to help help sell me on this. You mentioned that Republicans are going to be more sympathetic to your views and that our elected officials also often disappoint. Can you tell me about a time when you made life harder for Republicans?
Sure. You know, North Carolina was one of the last 8 or 9 states to not pass Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. And we were very happy with the fact that we had held out for so long. And then the Biden administration comes in and basically creates a signing bonus, is how it was referred to in the press here, for states at that point. And we're talking about 2022, 2023, that they would get an extra $1 billion if they opted into Medicaid expansion. Now, we had Republican supermajorities in both the House and the Senate of North Carolina. And all of a sudden, that free federal money was just irresistible. And it was like a tidal wave that we couldn't fight back. But our position had been for a long time that, one, Medicaid needed reform overall. It seemed silly to expand a program that needed reform anyway. And then, you know, there was always the talk about the pay ratios, how the federal government was going to pay 90% of the expansion costs. But that's deficit spending. The federal government is not operating under a balanced budget. All of that money is being borrowed. So how long were they going to keep up that 90% payment? All of that continues to be true. And we held all of these Republicans' feet to the fire. We lost that, but they were very upset with us for a while too. Don't you know, this is just good. This is going to help us in November. You know, this is just good politics. Well, no. It's not good. It may help you right now, but when you know, have an insolvent Medicaid program in the next 5 years, and that's what the math says from our research, what the math says from the Mercatus Center's research, what the math says from your own internal research, you're going to have a harder time staying elected, because then you're going to have to kick 500,000 people off the Medicaid program, and you're going to take a bigger political toll for having to kick people off of Medicaid than you got credit for letting them on.
How do you figure out the best way to influence public policy in North Carolina?
That's a great question. And you know, that's actually what our stated mission is to be the most influential public policy group in North Carolina. Now, we have a vision for North Carolina, right, that we want limited constitutional government to be sort of a cornerstone of how everybody thinks about state government, which will let everybody flourish. But we want to be influential. And how to be influential changes all the time. It's a multifaceted approach to, we have to have a comprehensive social media presence. We have to appear in the press as much as we possibly can. But then it's also noticed if we're not down at the legislature an awful lot. People view us as a resource. And that's probably the way that we are the most influential, is not we show up at this committee meeting to talk about this bill, or we show up to lobby one legislator at a time on this particular issue. It's being present in the legislative building so that we can be, you know, our lobbyists, and I've had it done myself. We're just plucked out of the hallway because these lawmakers face a variety of issues, right? I think the state house filed 1,000 bills, and that had everything to do with, you know, comprehensive education funding bills, to the state budget, to energy reform, to, you know,
making a new state symbol,
making a new state symbol, and increasing the hotel tax in Hyde County and Eastern North Carolina. They have to vote on all of these things. And so us being a resource on a good bit of the important issues that face us statewide, that's what really increases our influence, but being there and being available to them. And that's what we try to emphasize to everybody at the legislature, I mean, is our job is to be a resource to you. And if we are not being a resource to you, then we're not particularly valuable in this process. We are here to educate the public policy process.
Okay. I mean, I think absolutely you got to get in front of as many people as you can, including legislators, and demonstrate expertise. But the value you bring to the table is not actually just being there. It's the expertise.
That's right.
Who are your people, and why do they know so much?
That's
if they knew it all?
No, that's a great point, and it's a lot like a bullet, right? It's you have to have a charge in the bullet, and then you have to have something that the charge is delivering. And so you know, we have extra, you know, we have PhDs on staff in education policy, and you know, we election integrity, election reform has been a big topic for the past several years. We've been working on it since at least 2002 here, and so we have a political scientist on staff who does nothing but talk about the election law and study the election laws of North Carolina. We've got economists, we've got energy experts. You know, those are the people, and of course, you know, as researchers, they're not always the most conscious of how they're communicating, and that's not really their job. But it is their job to put out good, high quality work that can be used. And that's another critical part, that can be used by one, our own government affairs team, but also state legislative staff and state legislators to put it into legislation.
I want to come back to a thing that you mentioned at the beginning, that nobody's done it this way before.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that resonates with me because, you know, from working on in public policy for a while, I've worked with a lot of, like, labor policy directors who are essentially, like, all have the same job. Like, here's what we want. Here's our policy goals on labor policy. And they don't change from person to person, but exactly how they influence them, how they affect them, how they try to make a difference on public policy, it's changed every single time that we've got a new person in there. How does that work? I mean, shouldn't there be more of a guide on this?
You'd think there'd be more of a guide, but, you know, all we would do would be to learn from other think tanks, right, that have done it longer, except that they're also having to change with us at the same time. So it does change person to person. That's absolutely true. And if Michigan's legislature is anything like North Carolina's, it's a multi-generational legislature. Older legislators get information differently than younger legislators. We figure out how to communicate to all of those audiences. Think back to, you know, I think AEI, the American Enterprise Institute, started in 1932. How did they get their information to Capitol Hill? How did anybody know that they released a new study or new research or anything? And then I talked with John Hood, who's on our board of directors now, but he was president of the John Locke Foundation from 1992 through 2015. And he talks back in the days in the mid-90s when they were literally faxing their reports over to the legislature, hoping somebody over there just picked it up off the fax machine. And now it's, you know, we release a report, there's a press release, it's on the internet, we can email it, it goes to every legislator immediately. Not every legislator wants to read email, right? Some of them still want hard copies, so we have to print hard copies of the study. Some of them want to talk to you about it. Some of them don't want to talk to you about it. Some of them are only going to look at it if you post it on X or on Facebook. They only want to read sort of the things. If you don't get an op-ed in a newspaper about it, they may not know about it. And so that's what I meant by nobody's ever had to do it this way before. The Internet of Things has changed a lot of things. The same way the radio changes a lot of things. Television has changed a lot of things. And so we'll see what comes next. What's coming next is AI. And in a lot of ways, I think AI makes our work more accessible because those 800, 120 page reports that we write can be summarized very quickly so that lawmakers can digest them. And so in that way, I think that we keep up our work, the rigor of our work, but somebody can feed it into ChatGPT or Grok and get a summary very quickly that's digestible to them. It's not our job to provide those summaries necessarily, but that is a very interesting tool that I think we should figure out how to make it workable to make ourselves more influential.
What are some skills and expertise that you've had to develop in your role as president and CEO?
President and CEO, and Joe Lehman is a good and dear friend of mine. So is Mike Reitz there at Mackinac.
President, vice president of the Mackinac Center. Yes,
that's right. And they, you never know what you're going to have to be an expert in from day to day. I've learned more about tax policy and energy policy than I ever thought. And I started out working for a school choice group here in North Carolina. But then you have to, figure out or get trained in how to handle the media, work through how to handle the media, how to give, you know, the appropriate remarks so you don't bird walk off your talking points. Learning to lobby and learning your own lobbying style is a weird skill set. Everybody has to do it differently. I know I do it much differently than our director of government affairs here. I write much more. I actually use more math than I ever thought I would when I was in college, which is a strange sort of thing. But yeah, I find myself doing linear algebra all the time that I never thought I would.
I feel like middle school James is surprised at how much linear algebra adult James has to do.
But I do want to tell Miss Brooks, my fifth grade teacher, that I still have not drawn a parabola in this job. But otherwise, yes, I'm doing more math than I ever thought that I would. It's a fun role. I think, you know, I get to be blessed to be in a job that aligns very well, very closely to my own personal principles. I get to sleep at night. And in a lot of ways, I think that public policy groups are like superheroes and that our job is to help people flourish. Our job is to literally help people and change the world for them. But we just do it through public policy. So, no, we don't wear capes. We don't wear big S's on our chests. But at the end of the day, we know that we're successful if people's lives are better in our own state.
Donald, good luck on your attempts to shift the Overton window.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Overton Window, a podcast from the Mackinac Center. Please subscribe and rate. For more, check us out at www.mackinac.org. That's Mackinac with a C, like the island.